ask those, Brother Tom, would you do me a favor? Would you pass those forms out or make sure everybody gets one? Or Mark, somebody make sure these get around, everybody gets one. Praise God. I'd like for you to turn with me in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 6 tonight. Genesis chapter 6. Tonight we're going to look at one of those very difficult passages in the Bible. One of those very controversial passages in the Bible. Let's see if we can make some heads or tails out of it. Everybody has a copy of that little handout. Genesis 6 deals with a group here that's identified as the sons of God. We want to begin in verse 1. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair. And they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made him. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Also, if you'll read with me in verse 11, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. God said to Noah, The end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will utterly destroy them with the earth. And so God goes on and gives him instructions on making an ark, how to build it, what to build it of, how to cover it with pitch, and what to put in it, and the animals, and so forth. But for our focus today, I would like for us to look back to verses 1 and 2 and 4. Man began to multiply on the face of the earth. Verse 2, the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Verse 4, there were giants in the earth. If you have another version, it might read Nephilim, which is a transliteration of the Hebrew term Nephilim. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. All right. These sons of God, whoever they were, took the daughters of men. There was a race of giants, the Bible speaks of here, a race of giants, the Nephilim. It seems like these giants were at least somewhat responsible for the great deal of violence and so forth that was in the earth at the time, and the wickedness that spread throughout the earth at the time. The question is, who are these sons of God in Genesis 6? Now, I want to tell you, this is a question that you get a lot of different, well, you get several different answers and ideas and concepts about, and some people are very vehement in their persuasion one way or another. Now, this little handout that we gave you, the identity of the sons of God, gives you basically three of the main views. That the sons of God, in theory number one, were fallen angels. The second theory is that the sons of God was the godly line of Seth. The daughters of men, in that particular theory, would have been the descendants of Cain. The daughters of men, the Canaanite women, they were all evil, they were all corrupt. The godly line of Seth, they were all good, they were all godly. The third theory is that the sons of God were rulers, kings, princes, who had intermarried with common folk. Each theory has its own strengths and weaknesses. The sin, in theory number one, if fallen angels married the daughters of men, which were mortals, fallen angels cohabiting with human beings, then their sin would have been this marriage between the supernatural and the mortal. If it was theory number two, if this was the sons of God with the godly line of Seth, the sin would have been marriage of the holy to the unholy. And if it were dynastic rulers who adopted or cohabited with the daughters of men, the sin would have been polygamy. Now, some of the supporters of the first view that these were fallen angels include some pretty important names through church history. Philo, Josephus. Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, first century Jewish writer. Justin, Ambrose, the Apocrypha, the Book of Enoch, in the apocryphal writing. Delitzsch, if you're familiar with Kyle and Delitzsch, two of the most conservative Hebrew scholars ever, the Kyle and Delitzsch commentaries. Anybody who's a real Hebrew student, you know, that's a set of commentaries you want on your shelf, Kyle and Delitzsch's commentaries. They all believe that it was they were fallen angels. Driver of Brown, Driver, and Briggs fame, that was another set of Hebrew word studies. Casuto, Morris, Rad, Spizer, these are word study people. Let me go on and tell you that others who supported this view, who believed that the sons of God were fallen angels, were such notables as Justin Martyr, who spoke often. Now, Justin Martyr was a second century scholar and writer. He spoke several times in his writings about the sons of God being fallen angels. Philo, he's here, the Jewish philosopher. He was born about 20 BC. He attributed these as fallen angels. Tertullian, second century church leader, and so forth. Anyway, let's look at the evidence column here. Because as far as the supporters of theories number two and number three, basically you're looking at some of the more liberal scholars. The evidence for theory number one, the term sons of God, refers only to angels. Every place it appears in the Bible, it specifically refers to angels. Nowhere in the Bible, in the Old Testament, does that term refer to men. Always to angels. Jude 6 and 7 perhaps refers to that. It is the clear reading of the text. In fact, you take it literally, that's literally what it says, that the sons of God are actually angels. Young, in his literal translation of the Bible, he translates this where the sons of God, the fallen ones. That's how he refers to it. Because the Nephilim, the giants over here that were in the earth, that's what that literally reads, fallen ones. The Septuagint reads angels of God. Christ says angels do not marry, but it doesn't say cannot. In other words, it doesn't say they cannot be sexual beings. It just says they don't marry. Number two, the evidence for this theory is the concept of a holy line seems to be established. Hebrew indicates continuity from the previous chapter. The sin here becomes a common theme throughout the Pentateuch of the marriage of the holy to the unholy. The evidence that supposedly supports theory number three, magistrates or rulers are often referred to as gods, and kings are sometimes called sons of deities. The pagan kings were, at least. the problems. Now, each of these theories has their own built-in problems. The problem with identifying the sons of God as angels is that it seems a bit mythological, far-fetched, let's say. The sons of God, okay, here you have angels, fallen angels who cohabit with women and they produce an offspring of giants. That's stranger than fiction, really. I mean, that seems like Rosemary's Baby type stuff, you know, it's right out of Stephen King novels and so forth. Another of the problems is that angels aren't previously mentioned here. They just suddenly show up and they're cohabiting and so forth. Third problem, why is man punished by a flood for the wickedness of angels if it's their doings? And the New Testament support would seem to be questionable. The problems with the second view, if you make the sons of God the godly line of Seth, the term sons of God never means this elsewhere in the Bible. There is no precedent for translating that way. There's also no evidence that the lines are kept totally separate, and it doesn't account for Adam and Eve's other children. Thirdly, God has not yet begun working through one line. That doesn't happen yet, not till Abraham. God has not yet begun working through the one line. Fourth, the term for men is too general. The sons of God, the daughters of men, that's too general a term. It would need further classification to be understood otherwise. And in Noah's time, he's the only one who was holy. There's no evidence of a godly line of Seth anywhere. There is no such thing. That's somebody's imagination, in other words. And then the problems with theory number three. Kingship is not expressed in any way. Scripture doesn't consider kings to be sons of deity. And the need to be connected, the needs the connection of verse 4, the mighty men are the Nephilim, not the children of the union. Well, who are these sons of God? Let me just tell you first off that each of these theories, each of these views, has their weaknesses. Potential strengths, potential weaknesses. But I'm going to go a little bit out on a limb tonight. And I'm going to tell you what I think. I can't tell you what's 100% absolutely correct. I'm going to tell you which of these theories I lean towards, because it makes more sense, because I can put more pieces of the puzzle together. I tend to go along with theory number one here, that the sons of God are actually fallen angels, for several reasons. Number one, well, as is mentioned here, the term sons of God is translated angels of God in the Septuagint. Now, those Jewish scholars, you know what the Septuagint is? The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. When you do word studies, you're going to come across quotations, and then they'll give you the reference that this quotation came from. The Roman numeral 70, LXX. The LXX is the Septuagint. It stands for the 70. It was supposedly written by 70 scholars in a brief period of time. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of what? The Hebrew Old Testament. The Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, that's the Septuagint. The Septuagint, written by these 70 Jewish scholars, it's a translation by the 70 scholars, they translated the sons of God here as the angels of God. Also, this term, sons of God, appears 5 times in the Old Testament. In every reference, it means angels. Not once does it refer to humans. Now, I'd like to point out a couple of these references to you, because I think it'll help to build the case. And then we're going to talk about what these creatures do or don't do or can do or can't do. Job chapter 1, I'd like for you to turn here with me, if you would, first of all. Job 1, we'll look at a few verses over here. Everybody with me so far?
Amen.
These would be giants of stature, physical giants. Yeah. I don't know. But obviously Goliath was amongst, you know, this race of giants. I think they estimated that he stood anywhere from 8 to 11 feet tall. Yes, ma'am. Oh, okay. I thought you had your hand up. Job 1 and verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. Now I want you to notice in this passage that these sons of God obviously has to be a reference to angels, because Satan is right there among them. You know, these are angelic hosts. Excuse me. In fact, virtually everyone would translate the sons of God here as angels, with, I think that would be virtually without exception. Also, in chapter 2 and verse 1, again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. So again, we see the sons of God, and we see Satan right there among them, mingling right there with them, so it's obviously a reference to angels. One more passage, Job 38. Job 38 is one of those interesting passages. In fact, we read this passage in our study of angels. We were talking about the time of the angels' creation, and this is a passage dealing with God's argument with Job. You know, where were you, God saying, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth, when I stretched the line upon it? You know, God's going to speak to Job in construction terms, as though he was the great architect or the great carpenter of the universe, which he was, but he's speaking in human terms. Where were you when I stretched the line upon it? You know, when I measured things out and made sure it was all squared and so forth. He talks about, you know, if you know, who laid the measures thereof, verse 5? Who stretched the line, you know, upon it to make sure it was plumb and square and so forth? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Where's this earth? Where's it nailed to? How's it just flung out there in space and maintains its rotation and axis and so forth? Who laid the cornerstone thereof? Then he says this, verse 7, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. When God created the universe, when he created the world, when he flung the stars and the planets in space, and he talks about how the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy. The angels rejoiced. Literally the angels. That's the way the New International Version translates it. The angels shouted for joy. The Living Bible translates it that way. If you have another version, it probably translates it that way too. The idea being that every reference speaks of angels where the sons of God is used. They are sons of God by acts of divine creation. God created them. So here we have this idea that it's far-fetched to consider that the sons of God, Genesis 6, are fallen angels. But is it possible? Is it entirely possible, since the term is used of angels, since every place else it appears in the Old Testament, it refers to angels, and it's plausible based on the New Testament references that deal with the angels that sinned? For instance, 2 Peter chapter 2. I'd like for you to turn here with me if you would. 2 Peter chapter 2. What we're going to do is look at a number of passages and see if we can tie some things together. I'll tell you why I lean towards this view. Because there are a number of difficult passages in the Bible that I can tie up a lot of loose ends by by leaning towards this view. And quite frankly, I haven't heard a better one yet. So if you have a better view than Sethites or dynastic rulers, I'd be willing to consider it. But this one makes the most sense to me. 2 Peter chapter 2, let's read beginning in verse 4. 2 Peter 2, beginning in verse 4. For if God spared not the angels that sinned... All right. Now, we know some angels sinned, right? There were angels that sinned. He tells us, right, he didn't spare those angels that sinned. But what did he do with them? He cast them down to hell. Now, here's an interesting word. Basically, the two words translated hell in the Bible, in the New Testament, are Gehenna and Hades. Now, Gehenna is a place of eternal punishment. It refers to the place of the lake of fire, the place of eternal punishment. Hades simply refers to the realm of the dead. But this word right here that's translated hell is neither Gehenna nor Hades. This word is Tartaros. T-A-R-T-A-R-O-S. Tartaros. It appears nowhere else in the Bible. He cast them down to Tartaros. Now, he goes on and describes this place when he says he delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. So whatever Tartaros is, it's a place of darkness. In fact, as I look this up in my Greek word studies, I'm going to read a section over here from Wiest's New Testament word studies, read a little bit of what he has to say about Tartaros. The abysmal darkness, the supernatural darkness, and the idea of them being delivered into chains of darkness, it's a prison. They are reserved there. The idea is that they are under guard there. They are kept there. They cannot escape. Now think about this. There are angels that sinned who are to this present hour bound, imprisoned in this place of darkness called Tartaros. To this day, they are bound and imprisoned there. Now, he goes on and says, God did not spare those angels that sinned, but he delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. And he didn't spare the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly, turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes and condemned them, and so forth. The interesting point that we would make here is not only that some of the angels sinned, we know that some of the angels fell with Satan in his rebellion, right? But he says that these angels, are imprisoned. Now, obviously, all of the fallen angels can't be imprisoned. Else, how do we account for all the demonic activity that's going on in the world still? If they were all imprisoned, then the devil's out there trying to do all his dastardly deeds by himself, right? Unless this is Tartarus. Now we got sunshine here, can't be Tartarus. We had some today, anyhow. So, if not all the angels are bound, then only a select group of angels are bound. The angels, he says here, angels that sin. But which angels could this possibly be referring to? Well, it's interesting that the very next verse, you know, verse 4, he talks about the angels that sin, they are cast down into Tartaros and so forth. The very next verse speaks about Noah's day, Noah's world. Now I want you to bear in mind, Genesis 6 speaks about some sons of God that sinned, cohabited with the daughters of men, and that brought about Noah's flood, right? So in the context here, we've got angels that sinned and Noah's flood. Following verse, right? Same chapter down in verse 17, he talks about this place, perhaps Tartaros, wells without water, clouds that are carried without a tempest. the densest kind of darkness, a supernatural darkness. The later is called the Stygian darkness, supernatural darkness that permeate or expand. Well, it could be some. Well, these for fallen angels. That's generally the way it's described. And that's in Jude. I'd like you to turn over here to Jude with me, if you would. Jude, second minimum. But I'd like to point out here, Jude. Verse 6. Yeah, it's just one chapter. It's Jude 6. The angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. Even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Now, it seems that Jude refers to these same angels as Peter does. Now, here in Jude says they left their first estate. They left their own habitation, right? They left the realm, the place that they were supposed to dwell in, and apparently took up a habitation where they weren't supposed to. That these angels are now, he says here in verse 6, he has reserved them in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. They are now bound, literally kept under guard and confined in chains of darkness. Now, I don't think we're supposed to consider the word chains as literal chains, but their confinement is a literal thing. They are literally confined and awaiting judgment of the last day. And their sins are equated, the sins of these, if you like word studies, four volumes. Jude, listen to this. Jude, in verses 6 and 7, speaks of the angels which kept not their first estate. The words first estate are from the Greek word arche, which speaks of office and dignity. The word means the first in order of importance, honor, or position. The word speaks here of the exalted position of angels in heaven in contradistinction to the lower place occupied by the earth dwellers. So they left their first estate, they came down to the world of the earth dwellers. He quotes the book of Enoch here, where it uses arche of the watchers who have abandoned the high heaven and the holy eternal place and have defiled themselves with women. After informing his readers that they have been reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, the murky abyss designated Tartarus by Peter, Jude likens the sin of these angels to the sin of Sodom, Gomorrah, and the cities round about them. The words, even as, now you notice, again, that's verse 7, that's the way it begins. The words, even as, are the translation of an adverb which means literally, like as, or in the same manner as. The sin of these angels was of the same character as that committed by the inhabitants of the cities mentioned in verse 7. So, he goes on to say, this means that this phrase is to be construed with the verb translated, giving themselves over to fornication. The idea is the sin of the angels, fornication. That was their sin. Just as the sin of the Sodomites, going after strange flesh, fornication. Fornication is a big term, by the way. It doesn't mean just one thing. Fornication means all forms of sexual sin. It's a huge term. Every sexual sin basically fits under that one word, fornication. Incest, adultery, any kind of sexual immorality, that's all part of fornication. any kind of sexual immorality, sexual impurity, it's all part of fornication. Now, I'm going to read just a little bit more from Wiest because he makes the point, I think, better than I could. He says, this means that the comparison is between the angels of verse 6 and the cities of verse 7. This interpretation must be conclusive, all opinions to the contrary notwithstanding, for it is based upon the rules of Greek grammar. The sin in both cases is said to be fornication. We have the definite statement of Scripture, therefore, that the sin of the fallen angels was fornication. Excuse me. This fornication was in character the going after strange flesh. The word strange is the translation of the Greek word heteros, which means another of a different kind. In committing this sin of fornication, the angels transgressed the limits of their own kind and invaded the realm of another order of being. The sin of Sodom was the transgressing of the male beyond the limitations imposed by God. Expositor says in the explanation of the phrase going after strange flesh, in the case of angels, the forbidden flesh refers to the intercourse with women. In the case of Sodom, it refers to the departure of the natural use. Anyway, he quotes also Justin Martyr here. He says, Justin Martyr speaks of the angels who violated the taxin, T-A-X-I-N, of women by intercourse with them. The word taxin is used in the Septuagint when speaking of the priestly order, and the order is used to refer to a distinct class or kind of priesthood. Justin Martyr uses the word to speak of the distinct class in which women belong, that of the human race, as distinct from angels as a class or order of being. Now, he says a whole lot. I won't take the time to read all of this, but the bottom line is this. Let me just read this last little bit. He says the sin, the act of these angels in their act of fornication was their fornication with women. It was a mingling of two different orders of beings. The fallen angels and their sin of committing fornication with women of the human race is spoken also of in Genesis 6. We read that earlier. There is no good reason to doubt that Moses is referring to angels in the Genesis 6 passage, which was the prevailing view of the passage in the ancient synagogues of the Jews. Josephus, Jewish historian of the first century, speaks of the sons of God in Genesis 6 as angels and speaks of them in such a way to indicate that that was the commonly accepted interpretation of his day. It was also the view held by Christian theologians for the first 300 to 400 years of the church. So, did y'all follow? Yes, sir. In other words, female angels? No. Actually, what it refers to, the word strange from heteros, which is another of a different sort. The idea, again, there is that the angels went after women. That these beings went after women, human flesh. Apparently so. But that was not the normal way. That was not the normal. Remember, these were fallen beings. Yeah. There is nothing that would give us any basis to believe in an order of female angels. Yeah. Because they're always referred to in the Bible as men. Every single reference, they're men. They appeared as men. They manifested as men. They're called men. They're called with masculine pronouns, he, his. You know, they have men's names. Well, it would appear that, now you want to keep in mind, this is, no matter how we look at that, at this, we still have to keep it in the realm of a particular view or theory. We cannot speak in absolute concrete terms here, because that's all we're left with, is this is what we think. Now, it would appear that we're not saying that this view is without problems. The biggest problem you face is, okay, these are angelic beings. These are supernatural creatures, right? It is not possible, it doesn't seem possible, that these beings could take upon a physical body and cohabit with women and not only have sexual relations, but actually produce an offspring. That would, you know, that's pretty wild. I mean, that is Rosemary's Baby type stuff. You know? That's pretty wild. Is it, however, totally impossible, do you think, for something like that to happen? First of all, to say that it's totally impossible, I think we overstep our bounds a little bit, because we actually don't know what these beings are capable of doing or incapable of doing. We know that these are powerful creatures, that they are capable of doing all sorts of things and working miracles. You know, the Bible speaks in the book of Revelation, chapter 16, about these are the spirits of demons working miracles. We know they can do miracles. We know that Pharaoh's magicians could do miracles. I mean, they could reproduce all the plagues that Moses did, even to the point that Moses threw his stick on the ground and became a serpent. Jannes and Jambres, Moses' physicians, they did the same thing. They throw their sticks on the ground, they become serpents. We know, you know, there's a lot of things that sometimes we say is impossible. It's impossible for an angel to take upon itself the body of a man and have sex with a woman. Well, how do we really know that that's impossible? Because let's look at what the Bible does say. Angels walked into the door, the tent, by the tent door where Abraham sat. They sat down and ate with Abraham. I mean, they had a physical body. They ate. So if they could eat and digest food, I mean, who's to say they can't have sexual relations? They did the same thing with Lot. They went into his house. They were so masculine and physical in their bodies that the Sodomites, you know, surrounded Lot's house to get to these men, these angels, right? So I don't think we can dogmatically say it's impossible. They couldn't have done that, because we honestly don't know what they are capable of doing. Also, the argument that, well, what about Matthew, where Jesus said, in heaven they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but they are as the angels in heaven. Matthew chapter 22. What about that particular verse? Well, I have a book on my desk written by Billy Graham, and it's a good book dealing with angels. But he says of that verse that this means angels are sexless beings. But the Bible doesn't say that they are sexless beings. It just says they don't marry and they're not given in marriage. It says that, you know, they don't procreate in heaven, that the holy angels aren't having little baby angels. That's not what they're doing. They're not married. They don't marry. They're not given in marriage. They don't procreate. They're not having babies. Yes. Right. That seems to go hand in hand with these passages that say they left their first estate, right? They left the place of their habitation. They went after strange flesh. They were filled with a perverse desire for women. You know, that just gives me another thought. I'm thinking this even as I'm talking here. You know, we always cast out demons of lust. You know, what are these? These are spirits that incite lust and passion and this desire to be sensually, sexually gratified in people. What is it that drives people in this way? It's a demon, something that drives them. Yes, Blumhardt's Battle. Yeah. I haven't read it in a long time, but I remember basically what it was about.
That is correct. It was documented by
the German
mayor of that town and everything. Those particular demons had the capability of taking and rearranging the molecular structure of them.
That's true.
Because what they would do is that woman had a protrusion in the forehead and they extracted a knitting needle to the call.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an old book. I believe that book was written early 1900s, late 1800s, something like that, a book called Blumhardt's Battle, written by a German minister who, it was originally written in German, later translated into English. It's been out of print, I guess for a long time. We managed one time to pick up some copies of this book. One of the most incredible books on deliverance I ever read in my life. This fellow documented the sessions that he had with a particular woman in his church who had the most bizarre demonic manifestations you ever heard of in your life. You know, we've heard of people coughing and retching and vomiting and all sorts of writhing and barking and screaming, all kind of things like that. But this woman, when the demons would begin to manifest in her, bits of iron and metal and pins and nails and things like that would begin to protrude up from under her skin, and it would actually then begin to come out of her body. And this German minister would take those metal objects and put them in a glass jar, and he saved a jar full of metal objects that came out from under this woman's skin. Even they came at one point even out of her eyes. These things would protrude. Everything from nails to pins to, like Bob said, knitting needles. It was one of the most bizarre accounts I had ever read in my life.
And it was documented.
Documented. Right, she did get set free. This man was learning deliverance the hard way. But I have never in my life read anything even remotely similar to that, although we have heard of some pretty bizarre things, but that's about the most bizarre I've ever heard of. That's right. Brother?
Yeah, let me preface this by saying you're not your rabbit. Okay. I want to get back to your general
specific. All right.
I have a whole lot easier time, understanding the thing about the sons of God than I do verse 6, chapter 6, where it says, "And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth."
Yeah. In human terms.
When you're talking about, like, if
Well, let's consider that for a moment. Here you have a race of supernatural entities, these angels. Now, these angels are fallen. They are totally given over to corruption and uncleanness and the lusts. You know, these beings to this day want to occupy a human body so that they can gratify their sexual urges and desires and incite uncleanness in people. Is it possible that at this time, either this was allowed at that point in time to where an offspring was actually produced? Something happened. Let's acknowledge this. These angels sinned. Some angels somewhere sinned to such a degree that God imprisoned those angels, and they remain in prison to this day. So they did something really bad. They really went out the bounds. And is it possible that's what it's a reference to? They cohabited. They produced an offspring, and God then annihilated that offspring with Noah's flood, leaving not a single living being behind, only Noah and his family. Is it also possible that there were a particular order of angels? Now, we do know that there's different ranks and so forth, you know, in the angelic ranks. Is it possible that there was a special, perhaps, order of angelic beings who had that capability to reproduce, and that they were all in prison? I mean, those are only things we can speculate about. But something obviously happened. Very good point. Very good point. And that's why 1 Peter chapter 3, we're going to look there in just a minute. Why don't we go ahead and turn there? 1 Peter 3, this is one of the things that lends me to lean a little bit towards this view more than any of the other views.